Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. New Yorkers are notorious for saying things like, "Nah, I haven't actually been to the Statue of Liberty or the top of the Empire State Building or whatever, but it's just good to know it's there if I want to." Well, I have to admit, I'm kind of like that when it comes to the upstate town where I go every summer. Saratoga Springs has the Philadelphia Orchestra in residence, they get the New York City Ballet, their Performing Arts Center gets all the big bands touring through, and I'm like, yeah, it's nice to know those things are there. But I've never actually gone to any of them. I'm up there every summer to play the ponies. And if I've had a good day at Saratoga's historic racetrack, I might head down the side street to my favorite restaurant, which is right next door to Cafe Lena. Cafe Lena is one of the most historic folk music clubs in the Northeast. Bob Dylan played his first gig outside of New York City there. I know this. I'm glad it's there. But I'm a little embarrassed to say I've never actually gone in. It's just not why I go to Saratoga. Well, today, Cafe Lena comes to me, and to you, in the form of a new book and an amazing 3-CD set called From 40 Years of Live Performances. Hear what I've been missing later on the show. Also, live music in our own little Soundcheck Cafe from the elegantly named Philadelphia band Swearin. But first, did you miss the first ever YouTube Music Awards this past weekend? Well, never fear, the whole thing is viewable online. At YouTube, of course. That's the band Arcade Fire playing their song Afterlife, while actress Greta Gerwig does a kind of live music video thing, dancing through a couple of different sets and then finally out onto the live stage where the band is. Quite an opening salvo from the YouTube folks. YouTube, as you may know, is part of Google's online empire, and we've recently learned that Google is planning to launch a YouTube music subscription service. That could have a huge impact on the music world. Steve Knopper of Rolling Stone has reported on the plan and joins us on the line. Steve, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Sure, John. Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, what did you think of those YouTube Music Awards?
I like many people, just kind of flipped through them. You know, I don't think they were designed to be absorbed in one sitting. But mainly, I mean, the stuff that I saw, I liked the spontaneity of it. I liked how there were moments like Lady Gaga crying at the piano as she did her song, and some hijinks that by the rapper Tyler, the Creator. And Eminem's thing wasn't quite as spontaneous, but he had sort of like this black and white, kind of very sparse and stripped down set that perhaps you wouldn't have gotten in something as glitzy as the MTV Awards.
Will it be true for the blueprints to be raising youthful exuberance? Everybody left the room for a nuisance. Hit the earth like an asteroid, did nothing but shoot for the moon since. Get taken to school with this music, cause I use it as a vehicle to bust the rhyme. Gonna lead a new school for the students. I'm a product of Rakim's, not Kim's, your best to Rakim's. WAQ.Ring, get an easy thank you, they got slim.
I liked it. I thought that it was interesting, and it was fun to just kind of go through Twitter and go, oh, here's one performance I can watch. I didn't have to sit at my television and watch the whole thing.
Right. I guess a lot of us were wondering, why is YouTube doing yet another music award show? But then, as we've begun to hear these reports about Google and the music subscription service, is it all part of some big nefarious plan to take over the music world?
First of all, I mean, nefarious is a strong word, but you know,
I'm being a little facetious there, Steve.
Of course, but you're also a little late because YouTube has kind of already taken over the music business. I mean, you know, I'm exaggerating a bit because everybody thinks that Apple and iTunes took over the music business, but really, I mean, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and the only way she basically listens to music is by getting stuff on YouTube. And mm-hmm. The numbers that I've seen, you know, NPD Group and others that have done studies on this kind of thing, suggest that people are more and more, especially young people, getting all their music on YouTube. And it must be frustrating for the other services, you know, Spotify and iTunes Radio and the others that do streaming, in that a lot of music that isn't available on these, you know, quote-unquote official subscription services, you can get them pretty much all the time on YouTube. There are a lot of reasons for that, but it's really taking over. And it's also, through advertising, it's really starting to provide a pretty significant, if not business-saving, revenue stream for record labels and, to an extent, artists. And so it's become a big deal for a while, and I think the company is starting to say, well, how can we make an even bigger splash? How can we become even more dominant and really take advantage of the fact that we're seen as this music service? And that's where you get this subscription thing they're doing, as well as these awards shows.
So I guess that would be my question then, is if YouTube, as you say, has sort of, you know, cast this enormous shadow over the music industry, why does Google need to launch a music subscription service when it's already got YouTube?
Right. Yeah, that's the key question. And I spoke with various people about that in a story that I did for Rolling Stone. And the answer is kind of, YouTube is one thing, and people get their music videos on YouTube in one way. But it's not really designed to be a mobile app, a mobile service, the way, for example, Spotify is or Rhapsody has been for all these years, or the way iTunes Radio and Pandora are, certainly. And so I think that YouTube and its parent company, Google, are looking at that space, and they're saying, well, how can we take advantage of this money that people are paying, you know, $10 a month for Spotify Premium, and get into that business as an extension of what we already do with music on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of makes sense. It's smart. It's a space that a lot of people are jumping into right now. We're about to see the launch of Beats by Dre's subscription service, which will come out supposedly early next year. And it's a big space. A lot of people are kind of competing to make the advertising money that you can make off that space, but in addition, those $10 a month premium service fees, that looks pretty good right now for a lot of people. And there's a certain amount of, there's a certain pool of users, of buyers out there who are willing to pay for that. And all these companies are grappling to get as big a chunk of that as they can get.
We're speaking with journalist Steve Knopper. He's contributing editor at Rolling Stone and has written about this plan for Google to launch a music subscription service. What will their niche look like? Do we have any idea yet?
Yeah, the YouTube niche, it's a little bit hard to say. They haven't really given any details about the service yet. They haven't even officially announced it yet. So it's hard to say specifically what it'll be, but I assume that there will be a video component because that's YouTube. And you know, that might be a way that they distinguish themselves. But having said that, I haven't seen the service, and not very many details have come out.
But it will be sort of targeted towards Android mobile devices, right?
Right, exactly. And that's one big question that we don't totally know the answer to, is how will it sync with the other service that Google owns, which is Google Play, which also has a streaming and an internet radio component. So will this supplant that? Will it team up with that? Will both things exist at once? You know, we don't know, but yeah, I mean, the Android platform certainly is ripe for an opportunity for something like this.
All right, so Steve, you had mentioned before, you know, YouTube, this kind of music world colossus now, and in terms of monetizing all the music and the videos that are on YouTube, it's been a kind of a boost for a struggling industry. How artist-friendly do you think this proposed Google/YouTube subscription service will be? Because, you know, Spotify has been criticized for tiny, tiny payments to artists. Can YouTube do better?
Yeah, I mean, they can, but I don't know the details of that, unfortunately. I don't know, you know, exactly what the royalty payments will be to artists and also songwriters and all the different royalty streams that come out. They haven't released that information yet. The YouTube per se, not the subscription service, but YouTube as we know it, has a little bit of a different way, a different structure for paying artists and record labels, and that's kind of based on view count. And that can be significant. I mean, when you see the Psy video get, you know, 1 billion page views, and there's advertisements all over that video, we're talking about relatively significant money coming in that needs to be divvied up between the label and the artist.
Yeah.
Whether that translates to the subscription service, I'm not sure yet.
Okay, so then I have two final questions for you, and they both begin with, do we need? First question is, do we need a YouTube subscription service for music?
Yeah, you know, it's a pretty crowded space, and people, I think that it's confusing for the user. You know, I like Spotify, and I like RDO, and I like a few other things that I've used, but do I really need to rotate between 10 or 12 of them? You know, I mean, the Beats by Dre thing sounds really interesting, and I'm kind of excited about it, but will I really give up all these playlists that I've made on Spotify and shift to that, and similar to with the YouTube service? I don't know. So they all seem like they're just the same thing, different color, and I suspect that I suspect that the long-term play for all these services is that eventually there's going to be one or two or three big ones.
And so then my other question is, do we need YouTube Music Awards?
You know, I think the YouTube Music Awards were interesting. I think that the MTV Music Awards have been going on for many, many years, as you know, and they are always trying to do some big media attention thing. This year was Miley Cyrus. And I think there's room for some upstart, if we can call YouTube an upstart. It's owned by Google.
Yeah.
To come in and sort of try to do it a little differently. The thing I liked about the YouTube Music Awards was that, as per the way we do things already on YouTube, you could slice and dice all those events, all those performances, and distribute them through your Twitter or your Facebook or all these other social media things far more easily than you could do watching the MTV Video Music Awards on your cable account.
Right.
And so I liked that. I was actually following my Twitter feed that night, and it was sort of like, hey, everybody, look at this Eminem performance. Oh, okay, cool. I'll sample that. Then I'll sample this, the way I look at my Twitter feed regularly. And I liked that aspect of it. I thought that made it interesting.
All right, so the YouTube Music Awards, they are, of course, online at YouTube, and much, much more to come from YouTube and its parent company, Google, as we've been hearing from Steve Knopper, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Steve, thanks so much for talking with us again.
Of course. Thanks, John. Nice to talk to you again.
What does the fox say?
That's the Norwegian duo known as Ylvis performing The Fox. What does the fox say? On the YouTube Music Awards. And speaking of videos, one of the most popular videos on soundcheck.org is a collaboration we did with NPR Music and their series called Field Recordings. The video features singer-songwriter Bill Callahan, who used to record simply as Smog, performing in a community garden in New York's East Village. It's an intimate and transfixing performance of the song Small Plane, which is also on his new album, Dream River. Here is Bill Callahan playing in the 6th and B Community Garden.
To take me up, I watched and learned how to fly. No navigation system beyond our eyes. Watching I always went wrong in the same place where the river splits towards the sea. That couldn't possibly be you and me. Thank you. times you sleep while I take us home. That's when I know we really have a home. I never liked to land. Getting back up seems impossibly grand. We do it with ease. Danger, I never think of danger. I really am a lucky man. I really am a lucky man. Flying this small plane. I like it when I take the control from you. And when you take the control from me. Scan the path ahead and all around.
That's Bill Callahan performing Small Plane from his new album Dream River, recorded in a community garden in the East Village by Soundcheck and NPR Music as part of NPR's field recording series. Watch the video on our website at soundcheck.org. Up next, the story of a folk music institution located in upstate New York. It's Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs. And later, a performance in our studio from the band Swearin'. This is Soundcheck.
There's a small cafe in Saratoga. There the coffee's hot night and day. Owned by a lady whose name is Lena. She runs it in a very special way.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In upstate New York, there's a small coffee house that's been shaping American folk music for over 40 years. Cafe Lena has hosted hundreds of influential musicians, from Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie to Bob Dylan in his first performance outside of New York City. Jocelyn Arum is the director of the Cafe Lena History Project, and they've just released a book and a CD set about this nearly legendary cafe. Jocelyn, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me here.
It's not nearly legendary. I mean, it's a real thing. It's still there, right?
It's still there, and that's part of the continuing legend and story of Cafe Lena, is that it exists today for today's artists, and it was there, you know, for artists that shaped today's artists. So it's a really special place.
Now, what role did, I mean, it opened in 1960. How quickly did it become a part of the kind of folk music circuit?
You know, I'd say right when Lena began, she was already bringing in artists who were big on the scene in New York City and then became well-known in the upstate region. People like Dave Van Ronk, Jackie Washington, who was performing at Club Passim during that time, and Pete Seeger actually stopped by because it was important for him to be on the stage at Cafe Lena.
In the 1960s, my understanding is that Saratoga Springs was a little bit in decline. You know, it wasn't sort of the place that you had to be in the early part of the 20th century and sort of has come back again.
That's right.
So she was kind of like an outpost, I guess.
She was, and that's a good point. You know, in the early days of the cafe, she was coming up against a lot of resistance from people who thought this was a beatnik coffee house and a hangout for hoodlums, and they didn't really understand the significance and the value of what she was bringing, because there was a stigma around that kind of thing, but it was so valuable, and it's lasted to this day.
And when you say Lena, you mean Lena Spencer, the owner and right. founder of the club, which, as Jocelyn says, is still going strong. In fact, Arlo Guthrie was back in the club in 2010 to make this recording of City of New Orleans.
Writing on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors, 25 sacks of mail. On along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out at Kankakee, rolls along past houses, farms, and fields, passing trains that have no names, freight yards full of old black men, the graveyards of their rusted automobiles. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me?
That's a little bit of Arlo Guthrie recorded live at Cafe Lena, upstate New York, in Saratoga Springs, and the song City of New Orleans. The album is called Live at Cafe Lena, music from America's legendary coffee house. It is out now, and the book, also called Cafe Lena, is out now. Jocelyn Arum is director of the Cafe Lena History Project. We heard the audience there, and it was Arlo Guthrie, so the place was presumably packed. Mm-hmm. How big a room is it?
Well, the Cafe Lena is only 85 seats, and it's an extremely intimate and small listening room venue, so it gives you that experience of being close to these incredible artists in a way that other places just don't provide.
All right, so let's talk about the Lena behind Cafe Lena. There is actually a Lena Lane, you know, as you go and get your Hattie's Chicken Shack sandwich next door and then go upstairs to the club. And I say that as if I've done it. I've gone to the restaurant. I've actually never walked up those stairs to Cafe Lena itself.
Right.
But there's the little lane, little alleyway named after her. Who was she? How did she get this club?
Well, Lena Spencer was an actress and an artist who was living in Massachusetts. In the late 1950s, she met a man named Bill, who was a sculptor. And Bill had this idea to start a coffee house in the spirit of the European traditions and becoming a place of where people could really mix and mingle and exchange ideas. And of course, this was the folk boom in the late 1950s, early 1960s. They modeled it after the places that were here in New York City. And they brought this to Saratoga Springs. It was a booming college town, and they thought that the college kids would get in on what they were doing and they would find an audience, and in fact they did. And you know, she really fought her way through a lot of resistance to last through those times, and then when Bill left, she continued on. She used to say, through hell or high water, I'm going to keep this place going, and she really did.
And in 1972, I mean, she actually, we hear her, a lot of her on the box set, because it seems like she introduced everybody, mm-hmm. but she also mixed it up with the musicians occasionally. She mm-hmm. has a song on the CD.
Sure, and she was well known for acting in plays with Spalding Gray, Liz LeCompte, in her theater at the Cafe Lena, and performing and reading Dylan's Christmas and, you know, in Christmas time at the cafe, she would read, and all kinds of things she would participate in.
So this is Lena Spencer, the owner and director of Cafe Lena, and a song called, appropriately, Dear Little Cafe.
12 years ago, when we started the cafe, I came across a bunch of old 78s, and I found a record called Dear Little Cafe. And it was recorded by Nelson Eddy. And it's really a neat song, and I thought that I would try it out. The boys were here, so we kind of whipped it into shape. And I'll even try to do my Nelson Eddy imitation. We'll have a sweet little cafe in a neat little square. We'll find our fortune and our happiness there. We will thrive on the vain and resplendent, and contrive to remain independent. We'll have a meek reputation and a chic clientele. Things things will fall under our spell. We'll be so zealous that the world will be jealous of our sweet little cafe in a square.
That is Lena Spencer, recorded live in her own cafe, Cafe Lena, upstate in Saratoga Springs back in 1972. Lena died in 1989, but Cafe Lena continues. And in addition to speaking to Jocelyn Arum of the Cafe Lena History Project, we've also got some of the musicians who've played at Cafe Lena over the years, including David Amram, the composer and conductor who was doing world music years before anybody thought of coining a term like that, and who has played numerous times at the cafe. David, what was it like hearing Lena's voice just now?
Well, it's like she is still here, which she is not only in the memories of people who knew her, but in the whole atmosphere that she established in that incredible place. I hadn't been there in years, and Jocelyn called me up recently, and by an amazing coincidence, I was in Saratoga Springs playing with Willie Nelson for Farm Aid at this huge place, and Jocelyn was kind enough to battle her way through the traffic and drag me 5 miles over to the little cafe, and I walked up those stairs and said, wow. It had the same extraordinary feeling that I remember when I first played there. I believe it was 1972 was the first time.
Well, now let me ask you about why would you have played there? I mean, you by 1972, you had already been known as a composer. You'd written concert works. You'd done sort of jazz-oriented things. You'd been to East Africa. You know, you'd done all of this stuff. What was it about Cafe Lena that seemed like it would fit for you?
Well, it was Lena. She used to come to New York and see me play, and she had that wonderful low way of speaking. She said, David, you must come to the cafe. So when I would go up to Saratoga, I was there with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I went by, and I thought it was really a nice place, but I said, what can I possibly do there? She says, no, when you make up those songs with the crazy lyrics, people would love that. I said, well, that's okay for parties. I don't think everybody, I think, would ask for a refund. So finally, Rosalie Sorrells, who was a great friend of mine, said, man, you have to come up and play there. So I came up, and I was terrified. I'd never actually spent a whole evening playing without a great band or great musicians. But there I was, and I began to realize that in that ambiance, it would be possible for me to expand what I was already doing to. And it was only because of seeing and being with those folk players who were so terrific at communicating the nitty-gritty with the audience. Number one, that they're glad to be there. Number two, that they love the music. And number three, that they respect every type of music and every sincere person in the audience and on stage. And it was like a refresher course in everything that I've been trained out playing with the jazz masters and with the classical masters. It brought it all back home.
We're speaking with David Amram, who, among many other things, collaborated with Beat Generation writer Jack Kerouac. He is the subject of a children's song by the ever-popular Raffi. And actually, in a long and varied career, has performed at Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs, including this performance from 1974.
Sausages and racks. She makes life so beautiful. She makes New York nights. She never finished high school. She's always reading books. She knows her inner wish is purer even than her looks. My daddy was a working man. He had 10 kids in all. My mama sure stayed busy getting them to school each fall. Little mama's 20 now. She'll soon be 21. She can paint and play and dance and play guitar for fun. Think of how much she will know when she's 22. She's so free her mind can see right through me and you. She doesn't need a pedestal. She stands tall on her own. Her eyes can make a building smile. A laugh can melt a stone.
There's a little bit of David Amram live at Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs in 1974 in the song called Little Mama. And David, when Jocelyn found these old recordings, were you aware that this recording even existed?
No, I never heard that. And I said, wow. that young fella can really sing. But where did he get those insane lyrics?
Where did you get those insane lyrics?
Well, I was asked to when I was with RCA Classical, and had done a whole piece called No More Walls, three symphonic pieces, and the other side was all different genres of music from around the world where I had been. They said, why don't you do the same thing Lena did? Because I would do those songs at parties and things. And I said, well, I can't do 45 minutes of that on a record. I said, they put me into schizophrenic ward or closed your record company down. He said, no. He said, why don't you write some things out? So in 3 weeks, I had finished my book, Vibrations, and figured that was it as a writer. I sat down and wrote a bunch of songs, and that was one of them. And it was really fun to do that. And it made me appreciate real songwriters, the great songwriters who can say everything in one sentence.
Many of those songwriters have come through Cafe Lena over the years. And Jocelyn, when you did start digging up this treasure trove of old recordings, how, first of all, where did you find the stuff? And then how did you make the decision of what got onto the CD?
Well, I was so fortunate to have been contacted by one of the great audio preservationists, Steve Rosenthal, Magic Shop Studio right here in New York City, through our mutual friend Christine Lavin, the singer-songwriter who had been a waitress at Cafe Lena, as it turned out, who had taken guitar lessons with Dave Van Ronk at Cafe Lena. She connected us and she said, you know, if you find any recordings, I'd been working on the book project for a number of years, but we had started to have recordings come in. We had started to see names scribbled on old reel-to-reel tapes like Jerry Jeff Walker and Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and we weren't really sure how to preserve those, and it was so fortunate that Steve came forward and had the skill set and just the incredibly Grammy award-winning, you know, skill set to do that for us. And yeah, we had received...
Because I will tell you, as someone who has worked with analog tape for many years, you can really find yourself with a broken treasure.
Exactly.
If you don't handle that stuff
exactly,
right.
Yeah, yeah. And we just got to work right away collecting as many tapes as we could. Steve was sending me out to attics and basements, finding all of these tapes that had been hidden and dusty for years, and all of these collectors had kept them very well preserved, thankfully. We ended up coming up with 700 hours.
So what was the most surprising or astonishing discovery you made in this 700 hours of tape?
Wow, there were some great things that we were so excited to find. You know, I think a lot of the original introductions by Lena Spencer, those are precious to us because, mm-hmm. you know, just to hear her and the artists just revere her for those introductions, they're magical. And, you know, I'd say some of the recordings that were made around the time when an artist was just getting their songs out there and the world was hearing it for the first time, like Mr. Bojangles, that's a very early recording of that song, and it's beautiful. It's just so raw. You can hear the room, and some of these songs you can hear the audience, which is also nice.
New man Bojangles and he danced for you, worn out with you, silver hair and ragged shirt and ragged pants, the old soft shoes, jump so high, jump so high, and then he begged me that's now.
Jerry Jeff Walker, David Bromberg, Mr. Bojangles from Cafe Lena. The box set is called Live at Cafe Lena, music from America's legendary coffee house. The book, also called Cafe Lena. We're speaking about Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs. It is still part of the folk circuit, and musicians like Pete Kennedy are still performing there. Pete performs with his wife Mara as the Kennedys. And it's been actually a number of decades now, Pete, where you can actually sort of predict where musicians are going to play next. They're in the Village tonight. Tomorrow they'll probably drive up to Pauling and play the Town Crier, then up the Hudson to Saratoga, play Cafe Lena, over to the Iron Horse in Northampton, and then to Boston. Is that kind of the circuit that you're on?
Yeah, that's right. It's the circuit. And It's like in the old days, the jazz musicians had what they called the neighborhood, which meant you'd play the Howard Theater in D.C. and the Apollo, and then you'd and the Royal in Baltimore. And we folk people kind of had the same thing. And it is the venues that you were talking about. I've seen the Coen Brothers movie, and it recalls the early 60s in the Village perfectly.
Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, been all around this world.
I think that there were outposts, Cafe Lena being one of them, of the same kind of culture, that coffee house culture, where Charlie Bird once described to me how a typical night in the Village back then would be a folk singer, some jazz, a poet, and maybe a scene from Brecht or something like that, all on the same stage. And I think Lena was an outlier of that same thing. So if you played in the Village, that's a place where you could go.
Right. Now Lena herself, as I mentioned earlier, she died in 1989. So what is your experience of Cafe Lena?
We played there afterwards with Sarah Craig, who's been running the club and is a wonderful steward, I think, of Lena's philosophy. And so we went up there. We actually offered to play for the very first time for free. You were saying, well, why do people play at such a small place? And I think, like David said, it's a vibe. It's a real salon like you might have played in Paris in 1910.
You know, Café Lena is still there, but, you know, times are changing and the finances have always been a kind of a tricky tightrope for the people who run this club. Do you think Café Lena has a future?
I think there'll always be a sort of search for authenticity, and every generation has that. Maybe as the culture becomes more and more commercialized, that becomes even more important to kids. You probably have the experience, too. When you talk to young people now, they'll come to me and they go, I want to record, but I want to record on analog tape, and I want to put it out on vinyl. And they're doing the same thing I did, which was when I was a kid, one of my greatest thrills was meeting Duke Ellington. And a lot of my contemporaries, they wanted to, if they could hang out with Led Zeppelin, that would have been great. And I thought maybe that would be too for me. But to meet Duke Ellington, I was connecting all the way back to a much deeper root, I think, than what was available to me on the commercial radio. And I think that that's true of 18-year-olds now, too. Mm-hmm. You know, they won't meet Ellington, but maybe they'll meet someone that played at Lena.
Well, we're going to wrap up with the Kennedys' arrangement of a great old English folk song called Matty Groves. But before we do, Pete Kennedy of the Kennedys, David Amram, the composer and conductor, Jocelyn Aram, the director of the Cafe Lena History Project. To the three of you, thank you all for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you, John.
And there she spied
little Matty Groves walking in the crowd. Come home with me, little Matty Groves. Come home with me tonight. Come with me, little Matty Groves. Sleep with me till night. Well, I can't come home, I won't come home and sleep with you tonight. By the rings on your fingers I can tell you are Lord Donald's wife. What if I am Lord Donald's wife?
That's music from Pete and Maura Kennedy. They perform as the Kennedys, not surprisingly, and you can catch them at Cafe Lena if you're up in the Saratoga area tomorrow night. Up next, we introduce you to the band Swearin'. They'll perform live in our studio next. This is Soundcheck.
I was getting lit. The
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Swearin' is one of two bands that was born after the breakup of P.S. Eliot, a cult indie rock band that was fronted by the sisters Katie and Allison Crutchfield. The twin sisters now have separate projects, Katie with her solo work in Waxahachie, and Allison with this louder, punkier band called Swearin'. And Allison and Kyle Gilbride of Swearin' are here in the Soundcheck studio to play us some songs from their new album, called Surfing Strange, which was released just this week. We'll talk more about the record in a bit, but first, let's hear a song called Loretta's Flowers. This is Swearin'.
Mm-hmm.
about things you don't know or understand. When you come over, you talk to me about things you don't know. And it's a mess, it's a mess, it's a mess.
Called Loretta's Flowers, a live performance by members of the band Swearin' here in the Soundcheck studio. Allison Crutchfield singing, Kyle Gilbride singing and playing a bit of electric guitar here in the Soundcheck studio. Swearin's new album is called Surfing Strange, released this week. And Allison, this is obviously a much stripped-down version of the band.
Yes, definitely.
After I had introduced you as being louder and punkier. But, I mean, the songs have that kind of short, you know, punk length to them, not overstaying their welcome. Let me ask you first about the name of the band, Swearin', with the apostrophe
with
at the
apostrophe.
End. I'm not swallowing my G's. I'm pronouncing it the way you guys spell it.
Well, it's funny. We actually really couldn't agree on a band name at all, and we started playing together, and we started thinking, well, if we're going to play shows, we need to have a name, obviously. And Kyle had come up with Swearin', and it was on our long list of band names, and it was pretty much the only one we all agreed on.
Mm. Yeah, there was a lot of contention about this band name decision.
And the album name, Surfing Strange, are we talking about, like, internet surfing or real like wave surfing?
This was Keith's album title. I know what it's about, but it's kind of hard to get into.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's roughly about you can generalize it and say it's anytime you're surfing and, you know, making your way through new territory or strange territory. Something new. Something.
Right. Well, now, this isn't such new territory for you guys. You've been a band for, what, about 2 years now?
2 years.
Mm-hmm. Started in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. moved to Philly,
mm-hmm.
and for a while, you guys were all living in one house with Allison, with your twin sister, Katie, who now records as Waxahachie.
Mm-hmm.
And Soundcheck listeners, we actually shot a pretty neat video of Allison's sister Katie as Waxahachie during this year's South by Southwest Festival. You can find it on our website at soundcheck.org. Are they still calling Philly the sixth borough? Is that still happening?
I've heard that a couple times. No one in Philly says that.
No.
But, well, some years ago, a bunch of Philly artists put out a compilation CD, and they called it Music from the Sixth Borough.
Did they?
Yes. Oh, I mean, we're going back like 6-7 years now.
Yeah.
So I haven't heard the term lately, though.
I think Philly's trying to build its case for having its own identity.
For being its own city. Yeah, with its own
city.
They
do get a lot of carryover, and I think there's maybe some self-consciousness about it.
Yeah. So how is the scene there? I mean, we've heard, you know, Kurt Vile and people like that, and there was the Espers and the whole freak folk scene for a while. Mm-hmm. Is it still pretty lively?
It is. That, I guess that's, we were part of more of the like DIY punk scene there, but it's awesome. It's, I miss it. It's, yeah, it's very thriving. It's alive and well.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So when I used the word punkier in introducing you guys, I wasn't totally off base. And just to give folks an idea of what the full-on band sound is, I want to play a little clip from the song Parts of Speech. This is from the record Surfing Strange by the band Swearin. Some of a song called Parts of Speech by the band Swearin, late of Philadelphia. Where are you guys based now? Like, out of
it's
the van?
So
is that
kind
what
of. Van. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
The airport for the last month.
Yeah, right. Seriously.
We're speaking with Allison Crutchfield and Kyle Gilbride of the band Swearin. They are half of the band. So doing this sort of stripped down, I mean, you're still plugged in, but just barely. It's mm-hmm. one electric guitar and the two of you singing. Have you done a lot of this?
No.
Not too much, no.
Yeah. No, it's not.
This might be the third occasion.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the songs, are they sort of written this way, you know?
Yeah, more
kind
or less.
Kind of, yeah. I think individually, yeah, this is how we go about it.
And this record seems to have a lot more, Kyle, of you singing mm-hmm. than the previous work by the band. Is that, you know, kind of a change in a conscious change of direction, or
no? I
just
mean,
worked out that way.
Yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit. There was sort of us all living together, and I think everyone just contributing a little bit more to the process, and it sort of became a little more democratic. Whereas when we started, we sort of, me and Allison had this group of songs that we had written together, and we kind of were just, you know, shoving them into the band scenario. So there was more Allison songs. Plus, I think it's just whoever's writing more songs is writing more songs. Whoever's writing less. And yeah. I think I happen to have been a little more prolific this time around with the record, and I had a lot of songs ready to go, so they ended up on there.
Yeah, you and Keith too.
And Keith, too
Keith,
yeah.
Keith actually sings on this record, which he didn't sing on the last record.
That's Keith Spencer, your bass player.
Yes, Keith Spencer.
And we should mention Jeff Bolt, your drummer.
Oh, yes, always.
This next song is the lead-off track from the record. It's called Dust in the Gold Sack. Once again, Swearin', live on Soundcheck.
Daylight night on the turnpike, like the crunch of the black ice and the buzz of the semis. Noisy blare, ashing your long hair, you glare at the crack seen out a foggy window. Cracks in the ceiling above us, like dust in the gold sack. Cracks in the ceiling above us, like dust in the gold sack. Black tights, a life retrospective. Your text is subjective, and you're all. Cracks in the ceiling above like dust in the gold sack. Cracks in the ceiling above us, like dust in the gold sack. Back and forth down Bedford and no strand, you set things in motion while I drive you. Is unrequited, and we are defective. Cracks in the ceiling above us, like dust in the gold sack. Cracks in the ceiling above us, like dust in the gold sack.
That again is the band Swearin', half of the band. It's Kyle Gilbride playing guitar and singing, Allison Crutchfield singing live on Soundcheck. The song is called Dust in the Gold Sack. It's the lead-off track on the record, in which form, Allison, it's a kind of amps to 11, you know, rocker.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of nice hearing it that way.
Thank you.
You know, I completely missed that line about the viaduct.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's kind of a good line.
That might be partly in my fault for having mixed it.
No. My sister always jokes, there's a part where I say green alligator, and she thought that I said stretch navigator, like in that R. Kelly song, but it's green alligator.
Now, speaking of your sister, Allison, we mentioned Katie has her own band, Waxahachie, the two of you twins with, you know, your own history in a band together. Mm-hmm. Did you guys grow up in a musical family?
Not at all.
Really?
Yeah, we really didn't. I mean, our family loves music, and it was all, they were always playing music, but none of them actually play.
Right.
They were very, not confused, but a little bit confused when we, like, really took to it when we were teenagers. But they were very excited and supportive. I think it's a completely different world for them.
Now, you guys grew up in Alabama.
We did.
Right. And you, Kyle, grew up here in New York.
Yes.
In a musical family?
Not at all, either. No. Okay. I think I'm the only person. It was sort of a similar situation where I was, like, maybe 7 or 8, and I said, I want a guitar. My mom was like, why? Oh, all right. Let's get you a guitar.
Well, the reason I ask is that in coming up in about a week on Soundcheck, we're going to be talking about, you know, people introducing their parents to, like, contemporary music.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, having Allison, having two daughters who are, you know, touring musicians, I would assume your parents have probably been exposed to some stuff
they're
by
super,
now.
Oh, yeah. They're super. At least my mom. My dad is, like, excited to come to shows and festivals and stuff, but my mom is, like, into it.
She
knows about bands that I don't even know about. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, she's
Go
really...
Go mom!
I know. She's really into...
she's on top of it.
Sirius XMU, and she listens to Jake Fogelnest a lot. Like, she's really into Jake Fogelnest's show, which is really awesome and funny to me, but... Yeah.
So listening to bands that are still just emerging,
yes.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
She's got her finger on the pulse.
She definitely
of the indie rock community.
Oh. So have you introduced your parents to anything? Anything that took?
I'm trying to think. I think that when we were teenagers and we were really getting into, like, Rilo Kiley and the Strokes, my parents were, or my mom was, like, into it, but I don't know if it really stuck. Like, she'll still reference that. Like, if she's listening to a band today, she'll be like, oh, that kind of reminds me of Rilo Kiley.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's cool. That's, like,
one of her reference points.
It is one of her reference points, definitely.
And Kyle, how about you?
No, not particularly. I tried, but there's only so much. Everything I learned about music, I learned from that. You know, my mom was a huge Leonard Cohen fan, and
Nothing wrong with that.
And, you know, Bob Dylan, so I grew up, you know.
Mm-hmm. But she doesn't want to hear from your generation. Is that what you're saying?
Not so much.
Unless it's you. I think if it's you, then she does.
She's a pretty avid follower of my career.
Well, that career now includes a new record called Surfing Strange. The band is Swearin'. They've been playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Allison, Kyle, thank you both very much.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
This is Soundcheck. There's a lot more where this came from. Hear more music from our session with Swearin' and watch video of them performing in our studio on our website at soundcheck.org. Coming up on Monday, the influence of the Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Reich can be heard in a whole generation of contemporary composers and some rock musicians. But on Monday's show, Steve Reich reveals the influence he's gotten from the band Radiohead. We'll hear a piece inspired by two of Radiohead's songs. And an in-studio performance from the LA-based trio of sisters known as Haim. And a conversation with the cultural critic Chuck Klosterman about his villain-filled book, I Wear the Black Hat. That's Monday on Soundcheck. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, Jason Isaac, and Rick Kwan. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff, with Isaac Davey Aronson, Amy Pearl, Krista Ripple, and our intern, Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. That does it for Soundcheck today. Have a great weekend and be with us again on Monday.